Why do we want to make spectral reflectance and fluorescence measurement on the shroud? And here we basically have two analytical questions that we asked ourselves in Turin. Next slide. The first is, what substances make up the body image stain? Is it a paint or a pigment or a dye perhaps? Or is it some natural degradation of the cellulose in the cloth itself? And the blood stains, are they really blood or are they perhaps some other substance? We had hoped that the reflectance and fluorescence spectra that we took on these various stains on the shroud might be able to be matched with that of some known surfaces to throw a little light, more light on the subject. We also had thought that perhaps spectra taken on the clear area of the cloth might help us or someone in getting a little more information on the cloth, perhaps learning something about its method of manufacture, etc.
A quick look at the equipment that we use to make the spectral reflectance and fluorescence measurements. First slide. This spectral reflectometer fluorimeter was designed and built for the shroud work by the Oriel Corporation in Stamford, Connecticut. Next slide. It is shown here in action on the shroud. Next slide. Looking at a schematic of the instrument for reflectance measurements, the light from a xenon lamp is passed through a monochromator, which takes in white light and selects out a narrow wavelength band. This light is then transferred by a series of mirrors to a small 3x6 millimeter spot on the shroud. The light reflected by the shroud is brought through a second monochromator to a photomultiplier light detector. For reflectance measurements, the monochromators were scanned in unison across the spectrum. The wavelength is read electrically and sent to a horizontal axis of an XY recorder, while the electrical signal from the light detector is fed to the vertical axis. In this way, we were able to obtain reflectance spectral scans. Next slide. Spectral scans were run of a number of different points on the shroud, on several different body image points, on points scorched by the 1532 fire, and on bloodstain points. For reference, we also ran several points in the clear, unstained areas of the cloth, and we ran a spectrum of a white surface, magnesium oxide. To obtain an absolute reflectance of the clear cloth itself, we divided, point by point, the reflectance scan readings from the various clear areas by the magnesium oxide readings and replotted the results. Here we have the absolute reflectance spectrum of five average different clear points plotted with two individual points. We can see the higher reflectance at longer wavelengths, which corresponds to the yellowish look of the cloth. We can also see a variance from point to point. To answer the two major questions about the body image and the blood stains, our interest was not so much in the absolute reflectance of these stains as in the effect of these stains, which these stains have on the reflectance of the cloth. Because of this, we used as a reference surface not the white magnesium oxide, but the average clear area of the cloth itself. We call these relative reflectance spectra, relative, that is, to the underlying cloth. A word on the errors and variances in the reflectance measurement. The maximum probable instrument error due to noise or due to errors in reading curves is plus or minus 3% as determined by multiple scans on the same point. In addition, we have the non-uniformity of the cloth itself, which we mentioned earlier. The effect of this noise has been reduced by averaging data from several similar points. For fluorescence measurements, the source monochromator was set at 365 nanometers in the ultraviolet. The lamp was switched to a mercury lamp for more output. The detector monochromator scanned the emission from the cloth across the visible region from 400 to 700 nanometers. The raw fluorescence scans from the recorder were corrected for the sensitivity curve of the measuring system and replotted as corrected fluorescence spectrum.
Well, what do we learn from all this? Before we went to Turin, can we have the next slide, please? We ran some relative reflectance spectra on some typical pigments that we could obtain, quite a number of them. Here's two shown here. This was yellow ochre and burnt sienna. In each case, we saw in these spectra substantial changes in slope as we go across the spectrum. When we look at the photograph of the, look at the shroud itself. Next slide, please. We see by eye that the coloring of the image and that of the lightest of the scorches in this 1532 fire appears to be similar. But it's a little hard to tell by eye, and our eye can't see in the ultraviolet. So we were curious as to how the instruments would see this difference in spectral reflectance. We took a number of different body image points and scorched points of approximately similar reflectance and averaged them and plotted the average body image in versus the average scorch. Next slide, please. And this is what we saw. Considering the errors in the instrumentation that we mentioned earlier, we believe these curves to be essentially identical. With an almost constant slope throughout most of the spectrum. And also these curves, either one of them, look quite different to us than the spectra of any of the pigments run previously. Then when we looked at the cloth, we then looked at the cloth in fluorescence. Next slide, please. When irradiated with invisible ultraviolet at 365 nanometers, the cloth fluoresces a faint bluish color. And the intensity is quite low, really less than 1/100th that of the fluorescence of my white shirt. The next slide shows, shows the a spectrum of the fluorescence of one clear area, shown here at the dashed line for reference, and a number of the body image areas, shown down here. Here we see that the darker the image, in other words, the lower the image is in fluorescence, in reflectance, the lower it also is in fluorescence. And we also see that these curves tend to have a very similar shape, and similar shape to the fluorescence of the cloth underneath, which gives us leads us to the conclusion that primarily what the image is doing is just reducing the fluorescence of the cloth underneath, reducing it or as people say, quenching it. It's more or less as though the image is acting as a filter. Next slide shows us a similar family of curves compared with the clear area, but these are the scorched points on the cloth. Again, from a light scorch all the way to a rather dark scorch. And here we see a similar situation. We see the quenching of the fluorescence of from the cloth underneath. But in the case of the scorch, we also see, particularly at longer wavelengths, a little bit higher reflectance. In fact, this one went up even over that of the clear area. And then when we get to the dark scorch, we see that the peak wavelength has shifted to longer wavelengths. Here, the peak wavelength of the clear area is down around 440. And then gradually, as you get to darker scorch, it shifts to longer wavelengths until this curve, when the peak is around 500 or even more. To look at this more carefully, we went back to the averaging technique, and the next slide shows, focus it once more if you could, thank you. The next slide shows an average of clear area again in the dashed line. The next one is the average scorch and the average body image. And what we see here, and after doing a bit of calculation, we see that we not only have the reduction of the fluorescence from the cloth underneath in both cases, but we also have what we call some self-fluorescence, that the stain seems to be fluorescing itself. Now, the scorch stain fluoresces substantially greater amount than does the body image stain, but we believe that we see some self-fluorescence in the body image as well. Making the assumption that these stains do act as a filter, we calculated the amount of this self-fluorescence and plotted it down here. This is the self-fluorescence from a scorch and from the equivalent images, and you can see that the image self-fluorescence is quite a bit lower, but it is there. These curves, by the way, have a somewhat similar shape to that curve on the very dark scorch you saw in the previous slide. A possible explanation for this difference in self-fluorescence, as we will see later when we look at microscopic photographs, the scorch appears around all of the fibers. It's sort of scorched all the way through. However, the image appears only on the very front surface of the fibers, and we think that this difference might have something to do with this difference in the measurement of self-fluorescence. Now let's look at the blood stains. Next slide. Or I should say apparent blood stains. This is a curve of the average of five apparent blood stains. We see here a flat region from 350 to about 500 nanometers, and then a sharp rise at 550 with a small dip at 630, and then a rise again in the ultraviolet below about 330 nanometers. For comparison, we ran curves on a three-month-old blood stain that was given to us by Diane Soren. She didn't say whose blood it was. Also a sample of iron oxide on linen. Next slide shows that result. And here we see now the blood stain on the shroud. We see a blood stain, the three-month-old blood stain here. And the three-month-old blood stain has some absorption peaks in it here, and here, and here, and even there. And these are at the various wavelengths that the blood chemist would expect from blood on a piece of cloth that's that old. The blood stain on the shroud, however, doesn't show any of this. In fact, to our eye, which is untrained in this, appears to take some resemblance to that of the iron oxide sample. I will say that we have this dip here at 630 appearing in both of these, and I should caution people not to put too much significance into that dip, because that's in a region of substantially greater instrument error, and we're pretty sure, for instance, that in the iron oxide that dip is not real. The statistics show that it is marginally real on the cloth, but we're not sure of that either. So I wouldn't put too much significance in that, but even so, to our eye, the curve does look more like the iron oxide than it does on the fairly recent blood-stained linen. Now, what this means is very difficult for us to tell. As I said, we're not chemists, but whether this means that there's blood and another material, as Joe Aceta was suggesting, or we never did get any hold of 2,000-year-old blood stains to compare it with. Very, very hard to tell. This is at variance, by the way, with some spectra, that microscopic spectra that were run by Dr. Heller and Adler, and they're going to be talking about it later, and we're puzzled by that. So going back to the original questions, next slide, please. Number one, what was the body image stain? The body image stain, it does not look to us like it's a paint or a pigment or a dye. In reflectance, it looks identical to a scorch, which in fact is a degradation of the cellulose of the cloth. In fluorescence, it looks similar to a scorch but with significantly lower self-fluorescence that we mentioned earlier. Finally, what is the blood stains? We see indications that it's similar to iron oxide. We don't know what that means, and we'll leave that question up to the blood chemists, who will be talking later on or tomorrow.
We had a really wonderful time doing this project, working around the clock in the magnificent surroundings of the Royal Palace. It was a great week, beginning with the initial setup of our instruments. Next slide, please.
Slide.
Here was our setup laboratory, which was assigned to us, and the Oriole labs have never looked quite like this. Going all the way from this to the final ceremony. Next slide, please. This is the weighing in of the shroud, and here we see two members of the Italian scientific community, Professor Ganella reading the scale and Professor Arrighi taking the data. Looking on is Monsignor Catino, senior representative of the church. These three men and others there definitely made us feel all very welcome in Turin, and we certainly thank them.
We also thank the many employees of Oriel Corporation who worked very hard to put that instrument together and to ship it out. Thanks also to John Jackson and Eric Jumper and Dee German for asking us to join the effort. And to the many members of this research team who supported us and helped us and loved us all the way along. Finally, we, in this sleepy part of the afternoon, we thank all of you today for sitting through all this.
Thank you. Next man up is Sam Pellicori, sometimes better known as Agent X. You've got 10 minutes.
We never were told the fate of the poor boy that Dr. Gambisco was trying to crucify in the name of science, but I think I can explain one of the miracles he was talking about, namely how some of our equipment was released from customs. The actual truth was that 300 million lira, a bond of 300 million lira was put up to release that material. I realize that's only about $10, but small miracles we're grateful for also. Let me have the slide up there, please. One of the pieces of equipment that was rescued from customs was a little spectrophotometer that I put together just a couple months before going. It is portable, self-contained, and has digital readout. This does the similar thing to what the Gilberts does, but it's much more simple, and gave us a quick look. Next slide. Quick look at the reflectance information. Next, please. And next. And this is some of the data. The Gilbert's data was taken at a higher spectral resolution and over a wider range of spectral wavelengths. But anyhow, we got a quick look from this. These are a couple body image areas and blood and an intense scorch area. Once again, what you see is relative reflectance. What these curves mean when they're sloped this way is that the stains absorb more highly in the blue region than they do in the red region. And that's very significant. We'll get to that later in the program. Okay, we've got all this data. What do we do with it? We could publish it in our professional magazines and let it go at that. Or you can let it bother you and say, what does it mean? Well, you go to the laboratory and you attempt to reproduce the information and thereby gain a handle on deducing what possibly might be causing the spectral behavior that we see. Well, one of the first things to attack was, where do you get old linen? Even if it's only 600 years old, where do you get some old linen to play with? Well, one thing I did was to take some modern linen and to artificially age it, and then take spectral data on it. To start with, however, we have a have some data on scorched linen. The data was obtained as follows. We took the reflectance value at this blue wavelength, 666 nanometers, divided it by, I'm sorry, that's red, divided it by a near ultraviolet point, 387 nanometers, and plotted it then versus green light. We get curves for scorches that go like this. So this would be a very red scorch, and this would be a very, this would be an unscorched area. So you have this gradation in scorches. Next. Okay, now here is how to make linen that is very old. You bake it in an oven, in air, at a high temperature. You can choose your temperature such that you don't create pyrolysis products. I use, in this instance, 165 degrees C, and it'll happen in about an hour or a half an hour at this temperature. Or you can go to 130 degrees C, and it takes a couple hours. You can work down the scale. And this then is a plot at one temperature of the relative color versus the green color, where your eye is most sensitive, for various times of baking. Okay, it turns out that the shroud color is in this area. Next slide, that's the shroud background. Okay, the next thing to approach was then the body image. Now, of course, the body image is our most important goal. The goal of the program was to explain what the body image is. Okay, well, some experiments I did used olive oil, baked for various times at 140 degrees C, and they plotted then the relative reflectance versus, can you get that on the lower, raise it, versus wavelength. So this tells me the color that the olive oil stain approached or obtained with various times of baking. After 1.5 hours, it is, here's the unbaked, slightly yellowish, it absorbs a little more blue light than red. 1.5 hours, significantly yellow, and as you continue, you reach a point at, say, 3.5 hours where further baking does not cause more yellowing. This is an expanded scale. Okay, we will then compare these sorts of stains with the measured body image that the Gilberts obtain. The Gilberts have much more data than I was able to obtain in my little spectrophotometer. So that is the data to compare with. I'll talk just briefly about blood. I did some comparisons now. All this data, incidentally, was taken in the laboratory with a professional spectrophotometer using spherical integrators, which capture all the light that is scattered by the piece of linen. Okay, again, Mr. and Mrs. Gilbert's shroud blood curve versus wavelength. Once again, here is red light. That would be your Hindemian laser light, deep blue light. Okay, reflectance value. I put some fresh blood onto linen and did its reflectance curve and got these absorption bands. This is a very significant one for the porphyrin component of blood. These are also indicative of hemoglobin. I then soaked the linen in water and did the curve again, and we got essentially the same curve except with a slight change in the far red reflectance. Dr. Heller supplied a sample of blood which was denatured acid methemoglobin. At this point it was 18 months old and it was on old linen. I did a reflectance curve of it. That's the dashed line. All the curves in the laboratory have these absorption features. As Roger mentioned,
The shroud measurements do not have these features. This is something we are working on explaining. Possibly it's due to the fact that the shroud blood is more denatured because of its age, or perhaps the chemistry of the linen affected the actual absorption properties of the shroud linen.
What? Okay. Next. Okay, this is that curve in more detail. I think we can go on. This is a curve right off of the spectrophotometer showing on the vertical scale the wavelength in nanometers, and this scale is the reflectance. We always have a baseline, which is in this case a perfect white reflector, the correct for instrumental, the instrumental function. This curve, which you can barely see, is for linen which has no material on it. It's as received. And then, in this experiment, I soaked pieces of linen in potassium hydroxide. It's just a material to use, and it succeeded in yellowing the linen. So this was another way to yellow linen. And I varied the concentration then of the potassium hydroxide solution. So I'm only demonstrating to you the tools that we use in the laboratory to obtain comparison data from with which we can perhaps deduce the nature of the body image. We'll go into more detail on the chemistry in the chemistry session. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Moving right along, our next speaker is going to talk about the visible ultraviolet photographs, and it'll be Vern Miller from the Brooks Institute. Vern, can you find your way to the podium?
Taking so long to get up to the podium. Well, my responsibility in Turin was to, I might add that my highly enviable responsibility was to provide the photography, the scientific photography, and I shared that with several members of the team, Barry Schwartz, who is here, my employer, Ernest Brooks, one of my graduate students, Mark Evans, and several other people on the team, Sam Pellicori, Don Lynn, and Don Devan. So I hope I haven't oversighted anybody. Now, I might add also that every time I've explained my responsibility to any audience, almost everyone in the audience wonders why I was chosen, and they all feel that they would be perfectly adequate photographers to do that, and we all make pictures, and it is kind of hard to respond to that. And I'll try to justify that a little bit. I've worked awful hard for this, but I do feel a strong defense mechanism. And so I'm going to extend these pictures a little bit to make it look like I did an awful lot of work. we can start with the slides now, I'll maybe mention how I got into this. Don Devan first talked to me about it in the summer of 1977. And I would like to say that at that time I had never heard of the Turin Shroud, or any other shroud for that matter. So at least I entered into this without any bias and with quite a lot of objectivity. As Don explained the objectives to me photographically, he made a point of telling me that the artistic and creative photography had no part of this, and that I should try to make as dull of photographs as possible. And the most elegant thing that I might be photographing would be a piece of paper called a step wedge that he mentioned this morning, and that I probably wouldn't see anything that would attract my attention. And I can say that he was quite wrong in all of that, that I have been moved by this experience more than anything that has ever happened to me. And I've seen elegance beyond compare, and that I wish that I had taken the time to be a little bit more artistic. In the summer of 1977, after meeting with some of the people, we started the do test to decide on the type of equipment, the type of film that would do the best job for this. And I obtained a replica shroud from David Rolfe in England, and we practiced on that. And one of the motivations was to provide the highest resolution. The shroud had been photographed at least three other times in history, and there were some very good photographs made in 1933. I realized that our photographs would be compared to those and that we should try to do something different. And the approach that we did was to divide this 14-foot piece of cloth into several sections, and we could get